Welcome back to Season 2 of Blazing Trails. I'm Sabrina Barakzai, social and content marketer for Salesforce Strategic Events. We're sharing stories that reach beyond the tech industry. So no matter your career, location, or interests, we aim to curate a podcast that speaks to you. On today's second-to-last episode of Season 2, we are exploring art, activism, and how they often go hand in hand. One of the ways we practice our core value of equality is by encouraging everyone in our Ohana to awaken their inner trailblazer. Artists, activists, and advocates are prime examples of people who saw something they wanted to change and chose to take the reins and make the world a more equal place for all. Equality is a core value of Salesforce, but if we work together, it can be a core value everywhere, in every industry and every community around the world. The conversations we will explore on this episode help to shed a light on how to do just that. Last year at Dreamforce, we were lucky enough to have some of the most notable and accomplished trailblazers join us for part of our Equality Summit. These activists are using their platform to stand up for issues that really matter. Learn how these activists and advocates are creating positive change across racial, gender, LGBTQ, and disability equality. We will hear from some of today's most prominent activists, such as Deray McKesson, civil rights activist and founder of Pod Save the People, Heben Girma, disability rights advocate, Sarah McBride, National Press Secretary of the Human Rights Campaign, and Dr. Vivian Ming, theoretical neuroscientist and managing partner of Socos Labs. This conversation is one that will leave you enlightened and inspired. Let's listen in.
When we think about being a trailblazer, being an equality advocate, what we know is that somewhere along the line in our individual personal stories, there's usually a moment of awakening. And I'm curious if you would share with our audience here what your moment of awakening was. And let's start with Haben.
My name is Haben, and disability has been part of my life. There are a lot of obstacles. Not because of the disability, but because designers in our world often build things without thinking about different people. Humans exist in all different ways, and disability is one of the ways in which humans experience life. So I'd struggle to access books because libraries wouldn't have Braille books, or online reading services wouldn't design them to be accessible. And at first, I thought, maybe this is just how it is. And then I had a turning point when I realized we can do something about this. And that happened when I was in college. I went to Lewis and Clark in Portland, Oregon. It's a small school. And the cafeteria served as a central place for students to hang out between classes. When students enter the room, there's a wall with a print menu, and they'd look at the menu, pick what they wanted to eat, and then go to their station of choice. Blind students like myself couldn't read the menu, not because of blindness, but because of the format of the menu. So I went to the cafeteria manager and I explained, this menu isn't accessible. Can you provide it in another format, like Braille, or post it online in an accessible format so that all students can access it? I gave them several different options, and they told me, we're very busy. Stop complaining and be more appreciative. But if there's chocolate cake at station 4 and no one tells me, I don't feel appreciative. Back then, I was a vegetarian, and it's hard to eat vegetarian when you don't know what the choices are. Sometimes I'd stand in line for 20 minutes, get my food, find a table, try the food, and there'd be an unpleasant surprise. For a while, for the first few months, I just tolerated the situation. I told myself, at least I have food. Why should I complain when hundreds, millions of people struggle to get access to food? My mother grew up in Eritrea. during the war between Ethiopia and Eritrea. And when she was my age at that time, 18, 19, she walked from Eritrea to Sudan, spent 10 months as a refugee in Sudan, and then came to the United States. That was very difficult. And my life, by contrast, I grew up in the United States. I was getting to go to college. I even had access to food. So I told myself, why should I complain? And my friends reminded me, it's our choice. We can choose to put up with oppression, or we can do something about it. And I thought, maybe I could do something about this too. And I did research, and I learned about the Americans with Disabilities Act. People with disabilities have civil rights in the United States. And I went back to the cafeteria manager, and I explained their civil rights. I'm not asking for a favor. I'm asking you to comply with the law and provide accessible menus. And if you don't do this, I'm gonna sue. Afterwards, they changed their culture. They started providing accessible menus. The following year, another blind student came to the college. He didn't have to fight for access. He immediately had access because of the work I had done advocating. And that taught me that when I advocate, I make a difference, not just for myself, but for other people too. And that inspired me to go to law school, become a lawyer, and now I work as a disability rights lawyer.
Thank you, Haben. Dr. Mad Scientist.
Why try and compete with that? I actually have a story, and it's meaningful, and I think it will do some work. I'm actually going to hold on to it for just a moment and come back to it in a bit. Instead, I want to throw something different out, a different why.
Great.
It still gets at the same question. Is anyone here geeky enough to remember a show called Better Off Ted? All right. So do any of you remember the episodes? This is about a corporate research lab, which, you know, kind of touches in my life. If you saw me yesterday on the stage talking about artificial intelligence and machine vision stuff, in this one episode, they had implemented this new AI system that instead of having to badge through all the doors you do in a big corporate office, it would just recognize your face and open it up. And you could then, you know, control all the people who go everywhere. So what happened was it didn't recognize black people. And so they were all trapped in their office in the episode, and they couldn't get out. The solution for the company was to hire a bunch of white interns to follow them around to open the doors for them, which
of course.
Both of these things. I'll say the white intern thing just felt real to me in the corporate world. But the face thing isn't just a funny line. Like 30 years into real-time face detection, and they still regularly don't recognize guys like this. Famously, Google's a great company that I've done a lot of collaborative work with, but they had a face recognition system that labeled a black couple as gorillas. And from a technical standpoint, I see how it made the error, you know, as a machine learning person. But as a human, I'm like, what the fuck? That's, you know, maybe your 1% African-American engineering team should be more like the 6% that's actually coming out of engineering schools. And stuff like that then doesn't happen because you eat your own dog food and you see how this stuff plays out in people's family pictures. So, you know, I've got a personal story and I'll come back to it later, but in the tech industry, you see stuff like this happen all the time. And to agree with Haben, so much of it isn't villainy. I mean, it's out there in the world. But most of it is just, you know, you built it for the default. And the default here where we are tends to be, you know, a straight white guy that doesn't have a disability and didn't grow up poor. Let's be blunt about that, too. And it gets frustrating after a little while to realize that that may not describe anyone here. Like, everyone here has some facet in their life that makes them different, and yet we all willingly participate in a system that treats us all as though we're exactly the same. So I'll share something a little personal later, but that's a big part of what gets me going in the tech industry.
Thank you, Vivian. DeRay?
Yeah, so I used to be a sixth grade math teacher. Sixth grade is by far the best grade ever. Seventh grade is puberty and deodorant, and it is bad. So any of you who have seventh graders, like that moment where kids like don't realize they need deodorant and they really do is like a, imagine having your child and 30 of your child's friends in one room. Rough. But sixth grade was really beautiful. And one of the things about being a teacher that I'll never forget is the first lesson that I screwed up, and it was dividing decimals, which is also a really awful skill. And it was just really bad. And I taught 90-minute classes, and 20 minutes in, I realized like I just didn't, like they didn't get it. I didn't have anything else to say. And that was a transformative moment in my life because it helped me understand what the classroom can be. And it also made me think about my responsibility as an adult better. Like I realized that I couldn't call their math teacher. Like I was the math, it was all me. And that moment was like something I'll never ever forget. And we had the old school projector that had like all the hot air, you know, so it's like the hot air is blowing on the kids. And I'm just like, you know, read page 73. Like, you know, I didn't have anything else. And that was a crystal clear moment for me that changed my teaching practice forever. And it made me just think about what it meant to break apart these really complicated ideas into bite-sized pieces in ways that I could wrap up for young people. And that's changed me. And the second was the protest. So Mike Brown got killed on August 9th, 2014. I remember seeing it on CNN. I saw it on Twitter. I was like, something's off. Like, I don't know what is true. CNN made it seem like the protesters were crazy. Twitter made it seem like the police were wild. And I was sitting on my couch. It was August 16th. It was a Saturday. And I was like, I'm just going to go. I'm going to go for the weekend. So I couldn't call my dad because I know that he would say, don't go. And I was living in Minneapolis. And I felt like I couldn't just drive across the country and like not tell anybody. So it was like, call my father. No. And then I was like, I could call my sister, but it'd be like 50-50. Like, she might say I could go, might not. So I wait to call my best friend. He had just gotten married. So it's like, I wait till like 7:55 a.m. because we made this agreement that I wouldn't call in the middle of the night anymore because like he now had a wife. So it's like 7:55 and I'm like, Donnie, I think I want to go to Ferguson. Like, what do you think? He's like, if you think you should go, you should go. So I get in the car. I drive 9 hours. I put up a Facebook post. I get sleepy in Iowa. I sleep in front of a church. Like I pull over in front of a church, like put some clothes over my head, go to sleep. And I end up in the street in St. Louis. And you know, the rest is history in so many ways, but I'll never forget the second night I was there because it was the first night that I was ever tear gassed, and that just changed so much. Like I remember that moment vividly like it was yesterday. And if you ever saw us marching in the street in St. Louis, it wasn't that we thought marching was like an incredible tactic. It was that it was illegal to stand still in August, September, and October of 2014, that if we stood still for more than 5 seconds, we were arrested. And I'll never forget those moments. And they changed so much about how I think about the world. I remember that the trauma is today, that the trauma is still present. Like it's not something that happened a million years ago. I remember being dragged out of the St. Louis Metro Police Department by my ankles, by police officers. And like those things are things I'll never forget. So when people try and tell me like, we've made a lot of progress, it's like things have changed for sure, but some things have not. And that keeps me grounded in this work every day.
You know, I remember the first time I was tear gassed. I think we all have those fond, no, that shit never happened to me. That's quite an experience.
It's happened to more people than it should have though, yeah. You know? Yeah.
Well, first off, thanks for hosting this panel. I'm really excited to be on stage with all these wonderful folks. You know, for me, I think there's two points that come to mind in terms of my awakening. The first was my experience coming out as transgender. I was a junior in college. I was serving as student body president at American University. And I came out to the student body in an op-ed in the student newspaper. And when I came out, as scared as I was about the reaction from the college community, all I got was support. Someone compared the joy on campus when I came out to the feeling of winning a sports championship, which I don't know how anyone on AU's campus would know how that feels. But it was overwhelming, and it was total and complete embrace. But what was clear to me was that wasn't obviously the experience for so many other transgender people, not just on AU's campus, but around the world. And coming out was the hardest thing that I had ever done up until that point, but it was still relatively easy compared to the experiences of most people. And so I resolved to try to change that, to try to make sure that it wasn't a privilege to be safe from violence. It's not a privilege to keep your family. It's not a privilege to be able to keep your job or stay in school. And so I began working in activism. But for me, I think the main point in my life where sort of the skies opened and I saw the world, I think, in a way that drives me today, isn't through my own life as a trans person, but actually through my experience as someone who's loved someone who's transgender. And I met the man who would become my future husband, Andy, fighting for equality. He was a transgender man. We met working in DC, and I absolutely admired his work, his optimism, his humor. But shortly after Andy and I started dating, he was diagnosed with cancer. He went through surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy, and eventually got a clean bill of health. We kept on dating, we moved in together, and then Andy got the news that every patient fears. His cancer was back, it had spread, and for him, the situation was terminal. So when Andy found out that he didn't have much time left, he asked me to marry him. 3 weeks after his diagnosis, we married on the rooftop of our building. And then 4 days after that, he passed away. And I share that story because for me, knowing and loving Andy left me profoundly changed. He taught me how to love and be loved. He taught me how to live the values I fight for at work in my own life. But more than anything else, my relationship with Andy underscored for me that change cannot come fast enough. Now, as a young person, it felt like Andy and I had the world in front of us. But because of circumstances outside of his control, Andy was only able to live a quarter of his life as his authentic self. And so it really underscored for me what Dr. King called the fierce urgency of now, that every single day matters in building a world where every person can live their life to the fullest. And that when you ask any marginalized person to sit back and watch a slow conversation take place before you grant them equal protection or equal dignity, you are asking that person to watch their one life pass by without the respect and fairness we all deserve. And that is too much to ask of anyone. And so for me, that's what moves me and what motivates me.
Thank you all for sharing. It's very powerful. Haben, we're going to come back to you. Can you help educate our audience and share some insights on what a normal day is like for you and how you move about the world?
I move about the world through many tools, and technology has the potential to make life easier or more difficult, depending on how people design the technology. So this device that I use can connect to an iPhone. It can connect to a Mac or PC or tablet. And all apps and websites that are designed accessibly, I can use. So for example, mail, text messages, Twitter, Facebook, I can use all of that, and I use it day to day because those have been designed to be accessible. There isn't a special Facebook app or a special blind Twitter app. Instead, it's one app that everybody uses because they've decided to have a team that works on accessibility. There are guidelines online that teach tech developers how to make information accessible, especially technology. So if people use these guidelines, it helps people like me. It also taps into a large market, and it makes information more accessible to more people. So I strongly encourage everyone to look into accessible technology and make sure your apps and websites are accessible.
DeRay, staying on the technology question, you know, you are clearly one of the most prolific users of social media. And I'm wondering, how do you believe the use of technology has impacted social justice? And what more can technology be doing to advance your cause?
Yeah, think about, you know, you remember those early days, is some of the critics of the movement, they'll be like, you know, you guys were chasing the media. Like, you were just trying to get in front of the camera. It's like, if you remember, there weren't many cameras at the beginning. Like, we were the media. We were the people telling these stories every single day, and especially at the beginning. The first protest that you ever saw aerial footage of was Baltimore. In St. Louis, there was a no-fly zone declared over the city like 3 days after the protest began. So I think about social media as helping us fight back against these issues of erasure, and erasure often manifests in two ways. One is either the story is never told or is told by everybody but us. And in these moments, we became the unerased, which is really powerful. I also am mindful that we aren't born woke, but something wakes us up. And for so many people, it was like a tweet, a Facebook post, like an Instagram post that like helped them see the world differently. And that is incredibly important. And the third thing is that there's a style of organizing like just 10 years ago and before that required your body to be present at everything. Like the only way for you to make an impact was like if your body was in a room somewhere. And all of a sudden, social media allowed people to be present and to be really powerful and not have their body have to be there. So in terms of accessibility, like more people could participate in ways that we just didn't have before. I think that the question about like where can it go, I'm interested in seeing technology platforms that like help people build skills. Right now, when we talk about political education, it's mostly like knowledge, like you learn like a fact and da-da-da, but like who's building people's skills? Like I'm interested in that conversation. The thing about Facebook and like the Russian bots, you know, people didn't take it seriously until it was like 150 million people, more people than voters, like more people than people who voted actually participated or like saw those ads. So that is wild. So can we make a digital space that is inclusive, given that we've not been able to make an offline space that is inclusive? Like, I'm interested in that. Offline, it's still a pretty segregated world. Like, can we make a digital space that is more inclusive? And then, like, can we help people understand, like, the biggest issues? Like, I think about the police a lot. And like, you probably didn't know that a third of all the people killed in this country killed by a stranger is actually killed by a police officer. Like, that is wild. And like, what will technology's role be in helping us not only understand the issues better, but mitigate the harm that the issues can bring? I think has to be the next frontier.
Yep. That's great. So Vivian, this one's for you. Your research is fascinating. And I'm wondering if you could share a little with the audience about the tax of being different, but also the approach, approaching equality using data and science.
So it turns out not a lot of people that do the work I do think about it in terms of inclusion and bias and diversity. So I was the chief scientist at a company called Guild, and we were deep in the hiring space. And I had no background in this. I had started some startups. I'd been a neuroscientist or computational neuroscientist. But they wanted my particular skill set. And we were able to build a database of 122 million people. And in trying to figure out who Salesforce ought to hire or who Google ought to hire, or Citibank or anyone, we started looking, well, of course, you know, let's test the things that they're already hiring for. So what's the first three things that a recruiter looks at when they get their resume? They look at your name, your school, and your last job. God forbid you don't have anything to write on those second two lines. And so they look at your name, and it captures all sorts of things about gender, about race, and the necessary socioeconomic background required to go to a top-tier university. And it turns out none of that stuff was predictive. And looking at 122 million people, we didn't find any of that meaningfully said anything about the quality of work that people do. Your career trajectory, sure, it actually says a lot about that in ugly ways, but not about the actual quality of work. So I thought, you know, this is something we needed to quantify. So we started actually measuring what is in it. We built these algorithms that predicted how good you all are at your jobs. So if I equate for the quality of that work, then what is it that a woman has to do for the same probability of promotion, for the same quality of work? What extra stuff? What fancier school? How much longer do you have to be on the job? What extra busy work do you have to do? And we found it was pretty profound. The first comparison we did was Joe versus Jose. There's a story behind that, but just take it as it is. Turned out Jose in the tech industry needed to typically have a master's degree to be competitive against Joe with no degree whatsoever. So that's 6 years of education, 6 years of opportunity costs where you weren't getting paid to be a software engineer, comes out to about $750,000. That's ante, just to enter the workforce. It goes up as you go up. So we were able to measure, what does it cost to be a woman in the workplace? What does it cost? I had a former student of mine with epilepsy. She wanted, it was hard to get disability information. People don't put that on their LinkedIn profile, which is where a lot of our data came from. The first time I ever met Reid Hoffman, he said, I know you. I don't like you. But we were able to put all this data together and get hard numbers. And I thought, how do I communicate this in a way that is actually going to resonate, not just with people that already get it? Because really, I mean, if you fit any of the groups I just described, you're gay or you're black or you're a woman or you were just poor when you were born, I'm not telling you anything surprising to know that you had to work harder to get where you are. How do I communicate that to Jeb Bush, which I had the opportunity to? And I thought, let's call it what it is. It's a tax. It's a tax that doesn't pave roads. It doesn't build bridges. It's just heat loss in our economy of all the extra work people have to do simply to achieve the same outcomes. So we called it the tax on being different, and now it'll be a book that comes out next year. And we're able to look now, and with these massive data sets and deploying machine learning, to really look and measure, you know, why do women drop out of the workforce? We built an AI that crawled through the websites of 60,000 companies. Single biggest predictor of women choosing to drop out and raise a family, how many female faces are on the leadership team of their company? So it isn't just that women want to raise kids. It's that if you're already working 2-3 times as hard as your male peers, and you look up and there's not even someone like you in the C-suite, why are you going to keep doing that? So what we found is that it isn't just opportunity, but instead choice itself is fundamentally inequitably distributed. And we can't just expect people to choose themselves out of poverty, to choose themselves into being successful in this world. If we don't invest in them and create a world where their hard work is actually going to pay off, then they're just going to make the very rational choice to say, screw it, I'm not going to participate at all.
Want to experience the magic of Dreamforce but don't have a full conference pass? We are thrilled to invite you to register for a free Expo Plus pass for access to select events on Thursday and Friday at Dreamforce. Head over to dreamforce.com/free to register now. With the free pass, you'll learn about the latest innovations at select product and industry keynotes, test drive thousands of solutions, access hundreds of partners in the Customer Success Expo, and network with fellow trailblazers. Again, register at dreamforce.com/free, and we'll see you in September. Activism and impact go hand in hand. During last year's Equality Summit at Dreamforce, we got to hear from a panel about some of the many ways that art and activism come together and has impact on people around the world. This conversation brought together creative and engaged problem solvers, artists, and innovators alike. Moderator Carlos Watson, CEO and co-founder of Ozzy.com, is joined by Laureen Powell Jobs, founder and president of Emerson Collective, Will I Am, founder and CEO of I Am Plus, and world-renowned artist JR, and they discuss how they are using innovative approaches to raise awareness of critical issues and how to develop solutions to address these problems. Let's listen in.
We're going to have a great conversation today about equality and activism, education. And what I wanted to do in order to get us started, I always find, at least for me, it's helpful to get a little backstory to start. And so I wanted to ask each of the folks today, I wanted to ask Will, I wanted to ask Laureen, I wanted to ask JR, how did you begin to think about art and activism coming together? What was it in your background, your life? Was there a moment that made you start to think that art and activism belong together? And so, Laureen, maybe I'll start with you. When did you first start thinking about bringing those two together?
Well, after seeing that film again, I want to say that I'm a champion. And I'm a champion for others. I'm a champion for those who are like me, those who are not like me, for the human race in a way. So I love that phrasing. And as a champion, a believer of spreading the access to opportunity, I've tried sort of a straightforward approach, having been educated in sort of a straightforward way and working on Wall Street. And then when I had the opportunity through College Track to meet with students and to understand how we could bridge some of the gaps that were obvious and easily bridged, there were many, many more systemic problems that we discovered along the way, systemic obstacles that needed perhaps not a straightforward solution, but a solution that came and wrapped around that issue and other issues that came before us in a more holistic and comprehensive way. And a lot of that has to do with culture and behavior and attitude and identity. And that's the realm of arts and artists. And so then I had the great good fortune, in fact, to work with both of these extraordinary artists that you have today, to raise awareness for certain issues that are in front of us in our society today, and to have people connect to them in a different way that's perhaps not the straightforward literal way, but a much more deep, emotional, profound understanding of unequal access to education, of the purgatory that our immigration laws leave people in, so that it resonates and rests in people at a more spiritual and soulful level.
Well, what about you? I mean, we've seen, you hear Laureen talk about different tools that people use in order to try and promote change, and that people may connect with you as an artist in a different way than they may with a politician or they may with a journalist. Was it always obvious to you that you wanted to use your art for activism, or did that come later in your journey?
Well, activism is a very... It's a strong word. It's a word that comes with a lot of responsibility. But at the same time, when I was in the projects, I was active in the projects. When we were broke and poor, we handed out free lunches at the, you know, summer lunch program. My mom worked up at the school after school for the after school program to keep kids off the streets. My uncle was, you know, the little league coach to keep the kids away from the gangs. So activism isn't always because you have a position. Activism is what you do in the community because you have a position. And then you know, I was influenced by, of course, the Bob Marleys and the Public Enemies and the KRS-One's, Boogie Down Productions. And they're the ones who told me, hey, if you're gonna do music, this is why you do music. Mm. Either you talk about it, or you be about it and you do about it. And so Black Eyed Peas' success came because of Where's the Love. Although we made, you know, music because we were inspired by A Tribe Called Quest, that success came because of that song. And that took us to a whole different part of the world and speaking to larger groups of people. And that's responsibility. It tells you how to behave when you go out there in the world and what crowd not to be around with, because it doesn't really, you know, rhyme with the work that people are attracted to. It's magnetic and attracts you to folks to where now, you know, I never would have thought in my wildest dreams that I'll be working with Lorraine Powell Jobs. Never thought that. Didn't think it was possible. Didn't think that, you know, being in the projects when you're just trying to like stay away from police brutality and gangs and drugs, that I would work with people like Ron Conway and Mark Benioff. Didn't think that was possible. Didn't think that, you know, music, you know, and doing your little piece with Yes We Can could really hit the, you know, the needle, move the needle and be effective and help Obama take the lead from Hillary in 2008. Didn't think that music would be that powerful. But you're supposed to follow the leader, and those leaders at the time are the Bob Marleys and the Bob Dylans, and try to your part to do it from an honest, pure place to bring about, you know, resolution to folks out there, you know, that are hopeless, they've given up, they feel like they have no voice, the voiceless. And so there is a lot of responsibility with that word activism, whether you have a voice or not. Voice meaning like in popular culture, but there's awesome people in the community, the, you know, all the folks that are at the, you know, the park of recreation, teaching kids Little League, those are superheroes. You know, the after-school program teacher, she's a superhero. It's not because you're famous.
JR, talk to me about how your art began to move into activism. I mean, a lot of people have appreciated your work all over the world. You've touched on questions of immigration. You've touched on questions of opportunity, identity. But I don't think that's how it started.
You know, it started very simply. I was just a kid writing my names on walls, you know. And when you think about it, writing your own name on wall is the most egocentric, like, way of saying, I'm here, I exist. Maybe it's because, you know, growing up in the suburbs of Paris, you want to be, you know, you want to be out there somewhere in the world so that people can notice you. I was never really good at it, but I was good at climbing buildings and leaving some little marks up there, so it's still there today. But the day I discovered that I could take photos and print them and paste them in the street, and that suddenly people in a suit would stop and look at it, I was like, damn, the power of the image, the power of paper and glue is much stronger than I think. And for me at that time, I was only thinking that if I go to the north or the south of Paris, that's crossing the entire world. I knew nothing else.
Yeah.
I was really like, that's it. I going east or west or in a different arrondissement of Paris was like the biggest thing like that I had to accomplish. And I think I have to thank the mayor of the suburbs where I started, who sued me when I was 18 years old. And I was so scared to pay the fine that I left France for 1 year. And I went and couch surfed in other artists, you know, house around Europe, taking trains and sipping at, and I would each time ask an artist, do you know someone that you really love and respect? Oh yeah, you need to meet that guy in Italy. He's amazing. Let me connect you. And I would learn from them. And then slowly I started enlarging my photos. When I came back to Paris a year after, the riots had started exactly in the neighborhood where the mayor sued me. So my photos were on the back of the largest riots that we have in France since the French Revolution. So I was on the cover of New York Times at 19 years old by accident. It was the background of the riots. And I think at that moment, I understand that with those images, I could touch people, I could communicate. And even staying in the shadow, which I'm still doing partly because a lot of the work that I still do today is illegal, the little kid at the border was illegal, you know, and a lot of works like that I have to do this way. So I guess, you know, it's interesting that in some countries it's seen as art, and in some others it's still seen as a crime.
Lorraine, how optimistic are you today for the future opportunities of those kids?
Well, I never met Anthony, but just listening to him and knowing thousands of students like him, how could we not be optimistic? But for those students, those students are self-directed and they're making their way to higher ed. Unfortunately, if you saw the recent statistics actually just today that EdTrust West put out, listen to the statistic, in no county in California are Latino students prepared, the majority of Latino students prepared in either math or English language arts in the fourth, the eighth, or the 12th grade. So those are sobering and terrible statistics.
So does that, when you hear that and when you realize that, does that say to you as optimistic as you want to be, that you shouldn't be, that's naive, that's overly hopeful?
I think there's a difference between being optimistic and being honest about what's going on in our own backyard and in our country. I think I'm optimistic about human nature and human ingenuity and human creativity. I'm also optimistic that given the opportunity, those statistics can change quickly. I'm depressed by those statistics and I'm a little angered by them. Because it doesn't have to be this way. And the second we make an excellent education for every student everywhere a national priority, it could actually happen. So that's why we keep pushing, Taylor. That's why we keep communicating. That's why we keep doing the work that we do, because we all have to be relentless. When we see the truth, we have to speak the truth. That veil falls, you can't unsee it. And so we just have to keep pushing and pushing in every avenue we can, especially using the arts.
Well, how do you see it? Because, you know, part of what, and I hope we'll show some of what you've done in the neighborhood that you grew up with, a lot of people weren't graduating from high school. A lot of people were following a very different path. And you've helped create, along with Laureen and others, you've helped create one of the most successful college prep programs there. Why do you think it's working? And not just working, but working really well.
It's working really well because of how we started. And when Ron Conway introduced me to Laureen, what now, 7 years ago?
Yeah.
7 years ago? No.
You were both
Eight
young.
Years ago?
Yeah.
8 years ago. And it was like the happiest day of my life. It was because Ron was like, I reached out to Ron. I was like, you know, there's this program called College Track. I'm trying to look for Superman because I saw this movie called Waiting for Superman. And I realized that there are people like Jack Dangerman and Dean Kamen and Lorraine Powell Jobs that are Superman, Superwoman and Superman, and they exist. And the problem with that movie was they didn't tell you who Superman was. They told you that, you know, LA Roosevelt was one of the lowest performing schools in America. That's a school my mom went to. That's a school I should have went to if my mom didn't put me in the magnet program and I got bussed out to East LA. And so when Ron connected with me, it was on a hope. It was a whim, like, hey, can you bring College Track to LA? Because at the time, they didn't have a College Track in LA. And I wanted to have College Track as a spine and then a robotics program as the brain, the arms, and a coding program as the feet, and create a whole new body of, you know, encouragement and a faculty to change these kids' lives and transform them so that they are their own Calvary. And we were honest with them by saying, no one's coming to save you. There's a prison down the street that you guys are probably going to, you know, end up in. There's juvenile hall that you're going to go in and out of. The girls, you're probably going to get pregnant about before you're 22. Guys, you're going to be...
Wait, you were that direct with kids?
The first kids, yes.
What was their reaction? Did they get turned off by you being that direct?
No, because they know it's true. No one tells them that. That's the reason why they're ditching, because they know it's true. Their brothers are in and out of jail. They know it's true. That's business. They have a product. And they're recruiting kids at 9 years old. That's a business, bro. The prison is a business. So you gotta treat it like business and tell them that you guys are the agent of your own change. You are gonna save yourself. Here's a skill set. Here are these tools. And people want you to win. Here's some mentors. And, you know, and it worked. And your grades are currency, right? And so we use their grades as a way to, like, if you go from a 1.0, because these kids were failing, we didn't get like the best kids, we got the worst kids. From 1.0s to not even 0. whatever they were never attending, to 3.5s and 4.0s by the time we were finished, you know? And that first 65 kids, 100% of them graduated. 70% of them are now going to school with an engineering degree in robotics and computer science.
Well, yeah, they're all going on to 4-year, and in subsequent years, it's at 90%. But what he was saying is really extraordinary, that 70% of that class is studying a STEM field.
This podcast is brought to you by Dropbox. Dropbox is a leading global collaboration platform that's transforming the way people and teams work together. As a strategic partner, Dropbox is working with Salesforce to reimagine the work experience, building new solutions that eliminate disruption and help teams collaborate across sales, service, marketing, commerce, and more. Learn more at Dropbox.com. With Dreamforce Fast approaching only days away, we are also closing in on the end of Season 2 of Blazing Trails. Next time on Blazing Trails, it's our season finale, and as we head into Dreamforce 2018, we're remembering one of the themes that stood out the most from last year's Dreamforce, compassion. join us for a look at this broad topic from expert viewpoints and more. And don't worry, we'll be back for season 3 in 2019. Thank you for joining us on Blazing Trails. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and keep up with exclusive content from trailblazers around the world.